is the news.
Beijing says its proposal on the crisis in Ukraine is aimed at promoting political settlement. A new study shows nearly 200 U.S. banks are at risk of meltdown after the failure of Silicon Valley Bank. And Sudan's political factions agree to form a new transitional government. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. The Chinese president says that his country's proposal for solving the ongoing crisis in Ukraine represents the unity of the global community's views. Xi Jinping says Beijing's initiative is aimed at neutralizing the consequences of the Ukraine crisis and promoting a political settlement. He added that finding a rational solution to the crisis hinges on the concept of sustainable security and continuation of dialogue in an equal and pragmatic manner. Xi's remarks came ahead of his planned visit to Russia. China put forth its 12-point proposal to settle the Ukraine conflict last month on the first anniversary of the war. The initiative calls for a ceasefire and talks between the warring sides. A senior Russian official has warned of horrible consequences for international law after the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for the country's president. Deputy chairman of Russia's Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, says the ICC seeks to put on trial the president of a nuclear power, which is not a participant in the court. Medvedev says that this amounts to the collapse of principles of law. Russian Foreign Ministry earlier said that the arrest warrant against Vladimir Putin lacks any meaning or legal value for Moscow. The Hague-based ICC can only exercise jurisdiction within the countries that have signed to its agreement. Russia withdrew its signature in 2016. Western leaders, including the U.S. president, have also accused Russia of war crimes, a charge that Moscow rejects. A study finds that nearly 190 U.S. banks are at significant risk of collapse after the Silicon Valley and Signature banks crashed over a week ago. A survey by economists from four prestigious universities shows these banks will face a meltdown if their depositors are to withdraw their funds quickly. Such withdrawals are likely due to fears about uninsured deposits. According to economists, the Federal Reserve aggressive interest rate hikes to curb rampant inflation have eroded the value of bank assets. They say this has, quote, very significantly increased the fragility of the banking system. The economists are warning that even deposits insured by the Federal Reserve are at risk as its insurance funds are starting to incur losses. And Iran's top security official has visited Iraq. He says Tehran-Baghdad security ties must first and foremost include bringing to justice those involved in the assassination of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. In our news review program, we took a closer look at this issue.
Time now for the news review section. Stay tuned. Iran says that the prosecution of those involved in the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani is a top priority in security cooperation between Tehran and Baghdad. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, made the comment during an official visit to Iraq. He said that the passage of time should not reduce the significance of the assassination. He He added that the U.S. continues to destabilize the region through its mischievous acts that he described as something intolerable which should be ended. Now, for his part, Secretary of Iraq's National Security, Qasem al-Urouji, said, Baghdad is committed to a parliamentary legislation that calls for all foreign forces to be expelled. He added that major parts of the legislation have already been implemented. The Iran official is in Iraq for talks on bilateral security cooperation. Now, to put this to discussion, let me invite a couple of guests. Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, joining me from Islamabad. Also with me is Mohsen Saleh, academic and political commentator out of Beirut. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Mohsen Abbas, we have Mr. Shamkhani saying that, and as you also well know, that the U.S. is still continuing to destabilize the region, and these destabilizing moves should come to an end. Let's talk about this, and also the fact that, as also the National Security Council Secretary said, that the passage of time does not make forget what the U.S. did, and I'm referring to the assassination of General Soleimani.
Well, I think all of the points Mr. Shamkhani has made are reiterating Iran's very clear understanding that it is the United States of America, along with its Zionist ally, Israel, that is causing most of the destabilization through all sorts of kind of clandestine means. Deep state is busy working to finance all sorts of groups. Just to name a few, of course, is ISIS-K. That's the one that everybody knows. But lesser known ones are relevant in this particular negotiation and dialogue between Iraq and Iran. And those are namely groups, for instance, like the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, Kurdish Democratic Party, all of whose HQs are in Iraq. And it's these groups and it's kind of their connection with dissident Iranian Kurds, if you like, who have been operating on the borders of Iran and creating incursions, making huge terrorist issues for Iran, and it's so much so that Iran had to act, and it acted with precision missiles, suicide drones, which hit the bases of the KDPI and others, and basically over 14 people, I think, were killed in those attacks, and 58 were wounded. One, significantly, was a U.S. so-called citizen. Deep state was there indeed. So the fact is that Iran is primarily getting Iraq to sign deals to say, look, sort this problem out on our borders, because it's being manipulated and used by the Zionist, Anglo-Zionist Empire in order to destabilize Iran through their Kurdish proxies.
Okay. Now, Mr. Saleh, what would it take, in your opinion, for perpetrators, those behind the assassination of Iran's top General Soleimani, who played a major role in helping Iraqis fight Daesh terrorists, what would it take for perpetrators to be brought to justice?
It's about time for the Iraqi government to take the decision. The parliament, the Iraqi parliament, has a legislative decision that all forces, foreign forces, should go out from Iraq, especially the Americans who committed this historical and hysterical, crime against one of the officials, of the great official, the martyr, Qasem Soleimani. So it's probably they have to do something. They have to act against the Americans and brought those who committed this crime into justice. The Iraqis, especially the officials, they have to cooperate with the Iranian officials in order to send this big message to the authorities, especially the Democratic, who are having now a lot of problems with Donald Trump and his administration. The Iraqis are responsible for getting not only the truth, that which is clear and discerned, especially Trump and his aides, and whoever cooperated to take action in this crime, I guess they have to be brought to their justice.
Okay, thank you very much for your contribution. Mohsen Abbas in Islamabad and Mohsen Saleh in Beirut.
U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, it marked a major turning point for the region and the U.S. itself. Unbeknownst to the U.S., the invasion would mark the beginning of the U.S. losing its influence in West Asia altogether. The U.S. allies would also realize a declining U.S. power and how being a U.S. ally would not mean much unless security is taken into the hands of regional countries.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
Then U.S. President George W. Bush's 2003 decision to oust Saddam Hussein by force under the false pretext of WMDs, the U.S. unleashed its war machine on Iraq, and the country and the wider West Asia region would never be the same. The U.S. still contends with the consequences of invading Iraq 20 years ago.
There's not many who would come to the defense of this and think that this was a wise intervention. That, again, I mean, I think mostly because there are two kinds of critiques. One, which is there was no justification for doing it all in the first place, or which is one kind of critique. And the other is that, well, there was a justification, but only if you were capable of making sure that what came after it was not worse than what happened before. And the combination of the two makes this pretty flawed.
What came after depends on who you ask in the American administrations, past and present. Then U.S. President George Bush Jr. had a rosy assessment.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein was a ruthless dictator. His fate, in some way, was justified. Yet John Bolton believed removing Saddam justified the costs. But what was not justified was the U.S. forcing its version of democracy on Iraq.
Now, when it comes to wars, the U.S. has not won a war in a very long time. Take the cases of Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and Yemen. The U.S. has not been able to manage defeating the other side. This shows how the U.S. military is not capable of winning a war, which could be part of the reason behind the U.S. losing its clout with regional countries.
The U.S. invasion of Iraq was the beginning of major unraveling of U.S. policy in West Asia. It also revealed the true colors of a brutal regime. First, the cost of U.S. involvement. Pretty vast. According to a 2020 paper by a co-director of the Cost of War Project at Brown University, the U.S. price tag was nearly $2 trillion. That figure could be as high as $4 trillion. Then the human cost. U.S. soldiers, about 5,000. Iraqi civilians, over 1 million. The U.S. failure in Iraq was on multiple fronts. From the tortures at Iraqi prisons, like Abu Ghraib, which showed the brutality of the U.S. regime, to the waning support from the Iraqi population, the U.S. realized it had to pull out of Iraq.
Today, I can report that, as promised, the rest of our troops in Iraq will come home by the end of the year. After nearly 9 years, America's war in Iraq will be over.
I just decided we didn't want to do this stuff anymore. And that began, to be honest, I mean, that began with President Obama declaring that he was going to pull all forces out of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, another U.S. debacle. The nail in the coffin for a failed U.S. foreign policy.
And by the end of this year, the transition will be complete, and Afghans will take full responsibility for their security, and our combat mission will be over.
We're dealing very well with the Taliban. They're very tough. They're very smart. They're very sharp. But, you know, it's been 19 years, and even they are tired of fighting.
I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. Two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility onto a fifth.
Which brings us to today, where the U.S. influence in West Asia has reached a standstill. Nothing could be more evident of that than the recent Iran-Saudi resumption of diplomatic ties. Ironic that the country that the U.S. invaded back in 2003, Iraq, was the one that mediated between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which may lead to the ouster of U.S. troops from the region altogether.
Sudan's political factions have agreed to form a new transitional government on April 11th, paving the way for the return of civilian rule. The spokesperson for the signatories to the agreement says that the first step is to form a committee that will establish a draft and new constitution. The committee will include 9 members from the civilian groups and 1 from the army and another from a powerful paramilitary force. The committee members will sign the transitional framework for the agreement early next month, followed by a constitutional declaration on April 6th. Sudan has been gripped by political turmoil following a coup in 2021, which ousted the country's civilian government. Since then, the military leaders have been negotiating a deal with political parties to restore civilian government. A pro-Syria sit-in has been held in Rome and a number of capitals across the world as part of a campaign called End the Siege. The initiative was in solidarity with the Syrian people who are suffering from the sanctions imposed on their country by the West. Iran marks the 72nd anniversary of the nationalization of its oil industry, which was a significant step in the country's independence from the West. On March 20, 1951, members of the Iranian parliament passed a bill introduced by the country's democratically elected Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh to nationalize the oil industry. The initiative made Iran the first country in the Middle East to reclaim its oil industry from colonial powers. In a relation, Britain and the U.S. states, the United States that has imposed sanctions against Iran's oil sector and later colluded to stage a coup against the ex-prime minister's government in a 1953 coup. The CIA declassified documents of the incident in 2013, confirming Washington's footprints in the military overthrow of Mossadegh. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Happy New Iranian Calendar Year. Happy Nowruz.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Here is a part of a speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, after planting saplings on the occasion of Tree Planting Day on March 23. In our constitution, preservation of the environment has been stipulated. This is an important matter. No one should violate this law. This is one of the outstanding features of our constitution. I hope that, God willing, the people will be successful and our officials will be successful with God's grace in carrying out the necessary work that we all have a responsibility to do. I will also like to briefly talk about an issue that has been taking place recently and that is the issue of, some are saying, the poisoning of students. I'm well aware that our officials have sat together and discussed this issue. They are working hard and they have specified duties. I want to emphasize that they must earnestly investigate this matter. This is an important issue.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If there truly are people involved in this, if there are individuals or groups involved in this matter, the crime they have committed is a huge, unforgivable crime. If there are people involved in this, and undoubtedly there are certain people involved somehow, the responsible organizations, the intelligence and law enforcement agencies, they must investigate this matter and find the source of this crime. Both the perpetrators and all those who are involved. These perpetrators must be sentenced to the maximum punishment, and they must receive the maximum punishment, because this is not a petty crime. It is a crime against the most innocent members of society, that is children. And it causes fear. It causes insecurity. It creates mental insecurity in society, and it worries families. It causes these things. These are not small things. These must be earnestly investigated, and if people are convicted, there will be no pardon for them. Everyone should know this. They must be punished, and their punishment should serve as a lesson to others. I hope that the Almighty God will bless our nation, our country, our people, and the members of our society, and that God's mercy will be bestowed upon us as it has always been up until today. Praise God, and I hope that, God willing, the country's officials will be able to earnestly pursue and do things that they have in mind and move forward. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Tensions between the U.S. and Russia have risen to unprecedented levels after Washington accused Moscow of colliding with one of its Reaper surveillance drones, forcing it to crash into the Black Sea waters off Crimea. Russia denied it deliberately brought the unmanned aerial vehicle down. Moscow says the drone went down after stalling and never came into contact with another aircraft. Russia says the UAV was flying towards the Russian border without an active transponder, in clear violation of the restricted area established for the conduct of the special military operation. Two interceptors were dispatched to investigate. As a result of sharp maneuvers, the MQ-9 unmanned aerial vehicle went into uncontrolled flight, lost altitude, and collided with the water surface. The Russian fighters did not use weapons, did not come into contact with the UAV, and returned safely to their home base. That's what the Russian Defense Ministry stated. But the U.S. has rejected Russia's explanation, accusing Russian jets of an unsafe and unprofessional intercept of the drone. U.S. military officials claimed their spy drone was operating in international airspace when a pair of Su-27 jets appeared, sprayed it with fuel, and struck the propeller of the UAV, which caused it to crash into the sea.
But there is a pattern of behavior recently where there is a little bit more aggressive actions being conducted by the Russians. We haven't completed our analysis as to why that's happening. And it wasn't just involving us. There were some incidents earlier with the British and some other nations as well.
The U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has already reached out to his Russian counterpart, Sergei Shoigu, to discuss the incidents. The last time Shoigu and Austin spoke was in October 2022. The latest incident has further strained the already tense relations between the two nations. The Kremlin said on Wednesday that relations with the U.S. were in a lamentable state and at their lowest level. Calls are already growing loud in the U.S. to retaliate against Russia. Hawkish Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has suggested opening fire on Russian fighter jets that intercept U.S. drones.
They shot down our drone. What should our answer be?
Well, we should hold them accountable and say that if you ever get near another U.S. set flying in international waters, your airplane would be shot down. What would Ronald Reagan do right now? He would start shooting Russian planes down if they were threatening our assets.
Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, said the senator's call to shoot down Russian aircraft went far beyond common sense and risked all-out war between the world's largest nuclear powers. Since Russia started the military operation in eastern Ukraine, contact between American and Russian military leaders has been limited. Meanwhile, Italy's Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani has said that the drone crash represents a moment of great tension in relations between Moscow and Washington. He also urged the West and Russia to exercise caution so that they could avoid a direct clash. The crisis comes as the war is still raging on in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has said Russian forces must be stopped in Bakhmut and other towns in the east. Russia has said the capturing of Bakhmut opens a path to taking control of the entire Donetsk region, one of its central war aims. Russian forces and fighters from Wagner Group have captured Bakhmut's east, but have apparently failed to encircle the city. NATO also warned last week that Bakhmut could fall within a matter of days.
The United States has suffered some of its biggest bank failures since 2008. Silicon Valley Bank, the 16th largest bank in the U.S., failed after depositors hurried to withdraw money over concerns of a liquidity crisis. Officials say they acted to protect insured depositors. Regulators have taken control of the lender's deposits and transferred the assets to a newly created entity. Nearly half of the American technology and healthcare companies that went public last year after getting early funding from venture capital firms were Silicon Valley Bank customers. Moreover, a large number of startups will not be able to make payroll at some point in the next month if they cannot access their money. The lender had been under pressure lately due to fears of recession, higher interest rates, and a slowdown in the market for initial public offerings. The factors had made it harder for startups to raise additional cash. But Silicon Valley Bank was not the only U.S. financial institution to fail. Following the collapse of SVB, customers withdrew more than $10 billion in deposits from New York-based Signature Bank. Regulators have now said that Signature was taken over to protect its depositors and the stability of the U.S. financial system. Signature had 40 branches, assets of $110.36 billion, and deposits of $88.59 billion at the end of 2022. Signature Bank was founded in 2001 as a more business-friendly alternative to the big banks. It expanded to the West Coast and then opened itself to the crypto industry in 2018.
Signature Bank is a business mostly bank with actually pretty good deposits relative to lending. And it closed mainly because I think the same thing we're seeing across the banking industry, sort of a psychology of investors losing faith and the credit quality of banking in general.
And there are a lot of red flags here. That's certainly one of them, the concentration in one industry, the explosive growth over the last year. They literally doubled in size from 100 some odd billion to over 200 billion in assets, catapulting them into one of the largest size echelon of banks in the U.S. They also had a very, as they say in the banking world and accounting, they had a very mismatched portfolio.
The bank failures have sparked fears of contagion in the financial sector, not only in the United States, but also in other countries. Bank shares in the US, Asia and Europe have slumped following the collapse of SVB and Signature Bank. Investors have started to worry about the general state of the banking sector. Smaller US lenders were particularly hard hit. Investors are concerned that the failures are a sign of troubles at other firms. Several pension funds in the US and at least two overseas have lost millions of dollars due to the crisis. Institutions such as the California Public Employees Retirement Fund, the California State Teachers Retirement System, Korea's National Pension Service, and Sweden's Elective Pension Fund had reportedly invested in SVB. Analysts believe Silicon Valley Bank's collapse is likely to be felt across the technology landscape globally over the coming years.
But, you know, you also have the question of the impact on the financial technology and research and development, venture capital industries in the United States. There's $160 billion potentially tied up in this receivership that the venture capital industry could lose.
Governments in the United Kingdom and the United States have taken extraordinary steps to stop a potential banking crisis. The UK Treasury and the Bank of England have announced that they had facilitated the sale of SVB UK to HSBC, Europe's biggest bank, ensuring the security of £6.7 billion of deposits. President Biden has also pledged stiffer bank regulations, forcing regulators to step in with a series of emergency measures.
Americans can rest assured that our banking system is safe. Your deposits are safe. Let me also assure you, we will not stop at this. We'll do whatever is needed.
The crisis has underscored the risks to banks from the end of easy money. Global borrowing costs have risen as the Federal Reserve lifted U.S. rates by 450 basis points from near zero. The European Central Bank hiked the Eurozone's by 300. There are concerns that price inflation will stay high, something that would drive further rate hikes.
Tensions between the U.S. and Russia have risen to unprecedented levels after Washington accused Moscow of colliding with one of its Reaper surveillance drones, forcing it to crash into the Black Sea waters off Crimea. Russia denied it deliberately brought the unmanned aerial vehicle down. Moscow says the drone went down after stalling and never came into contact with another aircraft. Russia says the UAV was flying towards the Russian border without an active transponder in clear violation of the restricted area established for the conduct of the special military operation. Two interceptors were dispatched to investigate. As a result of sharp maneuvers, the MQ-9 unmanned aerial vehicle went into uncontrolled flight, lost altitude, and collided with the water surface. The Russian fighters did not use weapons, did not come into contact with the UAV, and returned safely to their home base. That's what the Russian Defense Ministry stated. But the U.S. has rejected Russia's explanation, accusing Russian jets of an unsafe and unprofessional intercept of the drone. U.S. military officials claimed their spy drone was operating in international airspace when a pair of Su-27 jets appeared, sprayed it with fuel, and struck the propeller of the UAV, which caused it to crash into the sea.
But there is a pattern of behavior recently where there is a little bit more aggressive actions being conducted by the Russians. We haven't completed our analysis as to why that's happening. And it wasn't just involving us. There were some incidents earlier with the British and some other nations as well.
The U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has already reached out to his Russian counterpart, Sergei Shoigu, to discuss the incidents. The last time Shoigu and Austin spoke was in October 2022. The latest incident has further strained the already tense relations between the two nations.
I just got off the phone with my Russian counterpart, Minister Shoigu. As I've said repeatedly, it's important that great powers be models of transparency and communication. And the United States will continue to fly and to operate wherever international law allows. And it is incumbent upon Russia to operate his military aircraft in a safe and professional manner.
Kremlin said on Wednesday that relations with the U.S. were in a lamentable state and at their lowest level. Calls are already growing loud in the U.S. to retaliate against Russia. Hawkish Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has suggested opening fire on Russian fighter jets that intercept U.S. drones.
They shot down our drone. What should our answer be?
Well, we should hold them accountable and say that if you ever get near another U.S. set flying in international waters, your airplane would be shot down. What would Ronald Reagan do right now? He would start shooting Russian planes down if they were threatening our assets.
Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, said the senator's call to shoot down Russian aircraft went far beyond common sense and risked all-out war between the world's largest nuclear powers. Since Russia started the military operation in eastern Ukraine, contact between American and Russian military leaders has been limited. Meanwhile, Italy's foreign minister, Antonio Tajani, has said that the drone crash represents a moment of great tension in relations between Moscow and Washington. He also urged the West and Russia to exercise caution so that they could avoid a direct clash. The crisis comes as the war is still raging on in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has said Russian forces must be stopped in Bakhmut and other towns in the east. Russia has said the capturing of Bakhmut opens a path to taking control of the entire Donetsk region, one of its central war aims.
Wagner PMC units have practically surrounded Bakhmut. Only one road is left open to Ukrainian forces. The pincers are getting tighter. If earlier the professional Ukrainian army fought with us, today we see more and more old people and children.
Russian forces and fighters from Wagner Group have captured Bakhmut's east, but have apparently failed to encircle the city. NATO also warned last week that Bakhmut could fall within a matter of days.
China's President Xi Jinping has pledged to bolster the country's security and build the military into a great wall of steel to defend Beijing's interests.
So as to guarantee a new development pattern through a new security architecture, we should further advance our mobilization drive in terms of national defense and military, and to turn China's military into a great wall of steel that will effectively defend the country's sovereignty, security, and development interests.
He also stressed the need for an improved national security system as well as an improved social governance system.
Security is the foundation for development. Stability is the prerequisite for prosperity. We should implement a holistic approach to national security and improve our national security system, strengthen our capacity for safeguarding national security, and enhance public safety governance, as well as to improve the social governance system.
He also reiterated Beijing's opposition to secessionist activities and external interference in Taiwan. Xi's remarks came in his closing speech to China's parliament, the National People's Congress, where last week he secured unanimous support for an unprecedented third term in office. During his speech, Xi also said China must achieve greater self-resilience and strength in science and technology, a call that comes as the United States blocks China's access to chip-making equipment and other cutting-edge technologies. Meanwhile, China's premier has said some people in the U.S. have been trumpeting decoupling from China in recent years.
I know that in recent years, some in the United States have been trumpeting the idea of decoupling from China, and sometimes it could become quite a hot topic on the media. But I wonder how many people can truly benefit from this kind of hype. According to Chinese statistics, two-way trade between China and the United States last year totaled $760 billion, which again set a new record in history.
Pyongyang said China and the United States can't and must cooperate, and there are a lot that the two countries can achieve by working together. He stressed that encirclement and suppression are in no one's interests. The latest remarks by Xi Jinping regarding China's focus on security comes as relations with the U.S. have hit their lowest point in decades. Chinese officials had previously warned that Washington's efforts to contain Beijing's interests could lead to conflict and confrontation between the two superpowers. America's increasingly confrontational posture toward China is a significant shift in the U.S. foreign policy that needs greater scrutiny and debate. For most of the past half century, the United States sought to reshape China through economic and diplomatic engagement. In the case of the Trump administration, through economic and diplomatic disengagement. The Biden administration, by contrast, has shelved the idea that China can be changed in favor of the hope that it can be checked. The White House has moved to limit economic ties with China, to limit China's access to technology with military applications, to pull back from international institutions where the United States has long sought to engage China, and to strengthen ties with China's neighbors. In recent months, the United States has restricted semiconductor exports to China, and this week it moved ahead with plans to help Australia obtain nuclear submarines. The administration also is seeking to impose new restrictions on American investments in certain Chinese companies. In treating China as a growing threat to American interests, it is acting with broad support, including from leading Republicans, much of the military and foreign policy establishments, and a growing portion of the business community. China also is demonstrating a greater willingness to engage in worrying provocations, mounting military displays in the South China Sea and Taiwan Strait. China and the U.S. have locked themselves into a new cycle of recriminations, provoking fresh worries that the world's two biggest economies are heading down a path that could one day lead to the once unthinkable, the possibility of open conflict. The dueling narratives brought into focus how the U.S. and China increasingly have one thing in common, a growing distrust of the other side. Even worse, the escalating rhetoric is entrenching divisions that could make it harder for both sides to find a way to coexist peacefully over the long term.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Allah, 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 Allah.
اون چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Imam Khomeini suggests that several practical remedies for curing anger. Blowing off the lamp of guidance, it reduces men to an utterly wretched state. Therefore, one should be on one's guard so as to dissociate oneself by some means before its fire becomes more violent. He should either leave the place where his anger may be provoked or change his posture to divert his attention.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear audience, you're listening to another episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we try to read some of the speeches and sentences of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi about different subjects and context. We do that in the hope to come to a deeper understanding of this great character. Now, in this episode, what we're going to talk about is Imam Khomeini's views on Islam and our deeds. In one of his speeches, he said, "If one wants to serve Islam, he should not expect all others to accept him." Well, you know that when you realize the path of truth, no excuse is accepted for not following it. One major justification of those not following Islam is that they are watching the number of followers. And if they find most of people converting to Islam, they would accept it. If not, they would use the few number of followers as a justification for their negligence. In this regard, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Ya ayyuhan nas, la tastawhishu fi tariq al-huda liqillati ahlihi." Our people, do not be afraid of the path of truth for the sake of its few number of followers. So we should keep that in mind, that such type of justification is in fact failed in Islam. Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi, sallallahu alayhi. On the other hand, when we widen the scope and talk about our religion in general, we come to a lot of enemies and non-believers who don't accept Islam and start to even bother the believers. Such a case has happened a lot of times in the history of Islam, and especially throughout the divine mission of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. Here, the point Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is making is that we should accept others' opinions about what we don't believe in. Well, I really like this ideology of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, because he is in fact showing respect to others who don't agree with us. His sentence is in fact representative of our Holy Prophet's manner in dealing with those kuffar or non-believers. He warned them about their hereafter and advised them to become Muslims. But when some of them didn't accept him, he just treated them respectfully and left them with their ideologies. And that is what we should learn from our great religion and Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's episode, we'll be discussing two major issues: how the people of the South Asian region share a close cultural bond with Iranians, and the Nowru celebrations across the subcontinent symbolizing common traditional customs between the people. So, stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how the people of the subcontinent share a close cultural bond with the Iranians. And we shall also take a look at Nowru celebrations across the subcontinent, symbolizing common traditional customs between the people.
India and Iran share a long and rich history of cultural exchange, which has left a deep mark on traditions, customs and practices of both the nations. The countries have a rich artistic and literary tradition that is deeply rooted in their shared cultural heritage. This connection between Iran and India made French thinker M. Grousset, while referring to the Taj Mahal, say that it is the soul of Iran that incarnates in the body of India.
The close relationship between the two regions dates back to ancient times when the two countries were connected by the Silk Road. The Mughal Empire, which ruled India from the 16th to the 19th century, also played a significant role in the spread of Persian culture in the subcontinent. The Mughals, who spoke Persian, adopted many aspects of Persian culture, including art, music, and literature. Persian miniature paintings, for instance, were widely popular in the Mughal courts, and many Indian artists were trained in this tradition. The Persian heritage also had a significant impact on the architecture. Many buildings and monuments built during the medieval period were designed by Persian architects and craftsmen.
Diwali has become a global festival, and in many parts of the world it is celebrated, especially in Iran and nearby countries and around the Black Sea region. And even the diaspora of these countries also celebrate. In total, more than 300 million people celebrate Nowruz all over the world. And this is this has become quite a significant festival around the world. And certainly its origin is said to be Iran, and that dates back 3,000 years.
Cuisine is another area where the impact of Iran on the Indian subcontinent is evident. Dishes such as polos and kebabs have Persian origins. Another similarity between the two regions is a common love for music, with Persian and Indian classical music having had a significant impact on each other. This shared cultural heritage has led to the exchange of religious traditions and festivals as well. The origins of Nowruz can be traced back to ancient Persia and the Zoroastrian religion, and it has evolved over time to incorporate elements from different cultures and traditions. Today, Nowruz is celebrated by people of various ethnic and religious backgrounds in India and around the subcontinent.
There are traces of this festival as like religious virtues. So there is no harm in it having like a touch of the religious aspirations or religious virtues to this festival, because it gives a little more flavor and respect to the day. And if it is celebrated as the first year of the year or the spring, or it is related to more cultural aspect and focused on it, certainly it would enhance and in its scope of a connectivity with the people.
Nowruz is a festival that marks the beginning of the Persian New Year and the arrival of spring. It's celebrated by millions of people worldwide, particularly in Iran and other parts of Central and Western Asia. In India, it's celebrated with enthusiasm by the Parsi community, who are the descendants of Iranian Zoroastrians. The celebration takes place on March 21st, which is the spring equinox. The festivity lasts for several days and involves a variety of activities.
the Parsi community in India marks the onset of spring with the celebration of Nowruz. The celebrations typically begin with a thorough cleaning of the homes, followed by the preparation of the haft-seen table, similar to that of the Iranians. This table is decorated with seven items that begin with the Persian letter seen, symbolizing different aspects of life. The items include sabze, or sprouts, which represent rebirth and growth, samanu, or sweet pudding, which symbolizes wealth and fertility, senjet, or Russian olive, represents love and wisdom, sib, or apple, is a symbol of beauty and health, serke symbolizes patience, somak represents life stimulation, and lastly, sir, or garlic, is a symbol of medicine. Other items that can be found on the haft-seen table are candles, mirrors, goldfish, and coins. On the day of Nowruz, people dress up in their finest attire and visit their friends and family to exchange sweets. Nowruz is an important festival for the Parsi community and serves as a symbol of unity and renewal.
Iran has always been a very significant position in the region. Not only in the Persian part of the region, but also into the subcontinent. Iran has always been admired as a bridge between the cultures. So this culture of Nowruz can certainly enhance ties between different nations in the region. And it has been playing. And if I quote Allama Iqbal, that is also known as Iqbal Lahori in Iran and in the Persian region. And he always, several times mentioned in his poetry that Iran could be the center of the Muslim in the world.
An important tradition observed on this day is the Nowruz prayers, which are held at the fire temples. People gather to offer their prayers and perform rituals, seeking blessings from God for the new year. Nowruz is also celebrated in Bangladesh, where the festival has its roots in the historical connection between East Bengal and the Mughal Empire. Shia Muslims in the country regard the day as sacred, holding special prayers in the homes. Nowruz highlights the importance of cultural heritage in shaping the identities of communities and nations.
The close link between the cultures of Iran and Kashmir suggests that the valley was hugely influenced by the Iranian customs and traditions and became a part of the huge Persian cultural realm. In the present-day Kashmir, the Muslim community, especially the Kashmiri Shias, celebrate Nowruz with fervor and zeal. Cleaning houses, buying new clothes, preparing elaborate meals are an important part of this spring festivity. Like in Iran, fish remains the most important part of the Nowruz meal.
Nowruz is a festival that has been common amongst the Asian Persians and Vedic Aryans of India. In the Kashmir Valley, the Kashmiri Brahmin community has been celebrating the day as Navre, which literally translates to New Day.
All the good thoughts, good words, and good deeds.
Even before the spread of Islam in the Himalayan Valley, the Kashmiri Brahmin community has been celebrating the festival in a similar manner as the Asian Persians. Since thousands of years, like the Iranian haft-seen, Tai Barun is part of the ceremony, where seven items are displayed symbolizing fortune, health, wisdom, etc.
The religious rituals they are donated to this festival is also a very polite, and it has very calmness, and certainly it can also blended with culture can help disseminate the message of peace, harmony, and living together.
Historians and anthropologists have alluded this similarity to the presence of a modified form of Zoroastrian faith called as Avestan. This faith has its presence in Kashmir, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, and some areas of northern Pakistan. Visit to families followed by invitations for lunch and dinner are central to the Nowruz celebration in the picturesque valley. Spending time in nature on Nowruz and the days following it is significant for Kashmiris. People frequent the famed gardens of the valley, take boat tours through the lakes. plantation is considered auspicious on this day with a belief that the plants planted on Nowruz will produce a bountiful crop.
In Pakistan, Nowruz is celebrated by many communities, including Shias,